Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, filling in for Ann this week. This hour on Tech Tuesday, we'll hear how the GPS system in your car may be giving away your home address and how other car tech is raising privacy concerns. We'll also have the latest gadget recommendations from Russell Holly, a writer at Geek.com. But first, maybe you're an art aficionado, but you also have a couch potato streak and you don't always enjoy that trek to the museum. Fear not, homebodies. Picasso, Monet, and all the other greats could be coming to a computer screen near you thanks to the Google Art Project. The effort by the tech giant is basically what it sounds like. Google wants to make digital versions of all the world's great pieces. The interactive website now includes more than 200 collections from some 40 countries, and admission is always free. Joining us now is a museum director who declined Google's offer to participate in the project. David Franklin directs the Cleveland Museum of Art. Mr. Franklin, welcome to All Sides.
Yeah, well, good morning.
First, a call to our listeners. Artists, how do you feel about the Google Art Project and the digitizing of paintings, even sculptures? What about art lovers? Are people really not that into art? Will this make art and the idea of a museum maybe more approachable for you, or are digital images just cheap imitations? Join the discussion. Call 614-292-8513. Send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. Post a message to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page or tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. Back to you, Mr. Franklin, from the Cleveland Museum of Art. In an op-ed for the Huffington Post, you tell readers point blank why you've declined two offers from the Google Art Project. For our listeners, tell us, why did you decline?
Well, essentially, we have our own website with high-quality images. We have a complete set of those images on our site, so I think we offer essentially what Google could provide, but in a better fashion. And I'm a little concerned about advertising a search engine through high quality masterpieces such as the Cleveland Museum of Art represents. So that troubled my ethical side. But also, there's no content on Google Art, so that disturbed me too. That there's this idea that just by looking at images, that somehow that was sufficient, but content is important. The three-dimensionality even of paintings is important, and so it just seemed to me, for all these reasons, not really something that this museum wanted to be involved with at this time.
In your op-ed, you also wrote, quote, "I'm opposed to how the art world has previously put technology to use in practice." What did you mean by that?
Again, I think there's tremendous opportunities for using technology and interpretation. So to deepen that is something that's really been on our minds here at the Cleveland Museum. And we've opened a new technological gallery called Gallery One, which blends technology, interpretation, and original art. So I didn't mean to be, as it were, negative, but actually to really approach this in a proactive way. And again, use technology in a way that becomes very efficient and fluent and helps visitors get more deeply into the art objects. That's really our goal, to use technology as a bridge and a lever into a much deeper experience.
We could talk more about the Gallery One project in a minute. Again, listeners, give us a call. What do you think about the digitizing and the technology being used in art? 614-292-8513, 292-8513. You can also email allsides@wosu.org and tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. And most museums, or at least many museums, have a gift shop that sells books documenting their collections. Some might even sell cheap likenesses of the art that's for sale or that's displayed in the museum. Not that different from the Google Art Project at its core, I suppose, right?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think even a book reproduction can provide a stronger image than something that's on the computer screen. I think, again, we've almost become almost inoculated from visual experiences by the bombardment of images on a flat screen. And I think that high-quality reproductions in books actually can go further to emulating a real art experience than can a screen, and where you click around. And that also I find is somewhat denigrating to the experience of a work of art, which, again, even a painting or a photograph or a drawing, even flat art, so to speak, needs to be experienced ideally in person. Your relationship to that object, the scale and proportion, the surface, all these things really need to be appreciated in person.
Sure, I can appreciate that. The same as sports or music, it's always better in person. I can imagine some people would counter that by saying you're shrinking the audience, limiting an artist's exposure.
Well, Google does not, I don't believe, that deals with much with contemporary art, and that's a whole issue. You might find some contemporary artists rather annoyed by that because of the copyright fees and so on that need to be honored. So that's something that those artists should comment on. But again, to put your art in the public domain requires a fee and a cost, and I'm not so certain that Google is addressing that issue.
And
it's
I guess
a form of piracy in a sense.
Sure. Again, just so our listeners are aware what the Google Art Project is. It's a website. It's pretty flash heavy, high resolution images. When you're on the site, you select the museum you want and then you start clicking through galleries. You can leave comments on an image. You can share it on Facebook or on Twitter. And as of yesterday, there were 214 collections from 40 countries. I found it interesting and kind of fun, but not for one second did I forget that I was on the internet and think that I was in a museum. Personally, have you spent a lot of time on the site, or much time? And how did, besides, you know, having one-dimensional images, how did you find the site?
I find it disappointing having two boys who play video games. I felt that the technology I see in some of these video games is superior to what you see in the Google Art Project, which is slightly ironic. It's not, in some ways, I just feel Google needs to raise its game as far as that art project is concerned. And it just felt a little clunky to me, as is so often the case with technology. It just seems out of date very, very quickly. But aside from looking at images on a flat screen and zooming in and out, which I find a very not only denigrating to the work of art, but just somehow disappointing. The total lack of content is disturbing to me. Art is not a video game. It requires a lot of deep thinking and a lot of experience and et cetera. You know, and people need to, I think, are inspired to learn, not just to glance around and click on a website.
And as you mentioned, your museum, the Cleveland Museum of Art, is not anti-technology. You did recently launch the massive tech project called Gallery One. Let's get into Gallery One. What exactly is it?
Gallery One is a unique space. It's really groundbreaking in world museums who are seeking a space that really does address technology and art. It's essentially feels like a gallery. It feels like part of the museum. It has interactives in conjunction with authentic works of art of the highest quality. So, for example, there's a Picasso in the space, and the interactives help you to see the works of art in a new way. You can emulate works of sculpture and have the images photographed and captured, and then you can also email them to your friends and so on. So there is that live interactive component, which is very physical, and that was something we really insisted on. And at the end of it, the exciting part is what we call the launch wall, where it's a 40-foot long interactive screen, again, unique in world museums, where every object on permanent view in the collection is on this screen, and you can touch it, enlarge it, and download it directly onto your iPad, and then that becomes you know, your own personal tour that you can GPS, as it were, around the museum and find those original objects through this launch wall. So it's a blend of different types of space, but essentially it's teaching you to use your iPad to engage with original works of art.
And we do have a caller on the line, John, calling from Columbus. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes, I just want to comment on the gentleman. He says that the art, you know, it shouldn't be looked at as a video game. But even though there are certain games out there as well, you know, when I sit and play, it makes me want to go and do more research about a particular type of art. So seeing the images, art images on Google, it endorsed me to go out there and see where it came from, and it kind of helped introduce me into that, into the art, and wanted to learn more about it. So I think it's a good thing.
David Franklin, is the worry that maybe people won't, a lot of people won't feel that way. They'll be complacent and maybe be satisfied with the Google Art Project and not seek out the actual works.
Oh, I think that would be a genuine danger. You would not necessarily be intrigued to go further. And I think what we hope is to drive people to our own website. So if you're interested in the Cleveland Museum of Art, you can find that much and more. Let's not forget either, the Google Art Project is not exhaustive. It's a selection of images from different museums, and whereas we provide a full database of images on our own website, and where we can control the quality and provide information, provide content that is so important than mm-hmm. just sort of superficially glancing at an image.
Well, John, thanks so much for your call. We do have another caller on the line, Noel, calling from Mansfield. Go ahead, Noel.
I feel with families all going their separate directions that the computer is keeping them from bonding and having this wonderful experience of going to a museum together.
Is there something to that, Mr. Franklin? Is there a social aspect to going to the museum?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I think we're trying to drive is people away from their computers into the museum. And we're really stressing the importance of an authentic experience of original works of art in a social setting. Our museum is free and open to the public. We have no general admission charge. It's very accessible to families. We have programs for families. And fundamentally, I just believe that art, looking at art, experiencing art, makes us more sensitive and kinder to each other. When we see those great works of art, there's almost a reflex in ourselves that makes us want to be kinder and more caring. So definitely I see the museum as a site for that almost social impact, definitely.
Noel, I assume you agree with Mr. Franklin's comments there.
Yes, I do. And I also think that if my body is standing in front of a piece of art, you get vibes from it and you're seeing it in person and not just an image. Like you could look at a magazine and see images, but mm-hmm. you need to be there.
All good points. Noel, thanks for your call. Mr. Franklin, we touched on it at the beginning of this segment, piracy concerns. That is the biggest beef with music being shared online, that it's leaving artists out in the cold and it's a form of piracy. What exactly are your piracy concerns with this project or projects like it?
Well, contemporary art is a difficult thing, and some modern art with estates would have copyright concerns. So when these images get put on certain types of website or in the public domain, those artists will lose control of that, and their income will dissipate. So I think this is also why museum websites are so important, because we're obviously very respectful and secure in terms of paying our contemporary artists and our artist estate. So there's absolutely no issues there that we're not being fully transparent and respectful of the income that generates for these artists.
Mm-hmm. Well, David Franklin is the director of the Cleveland Museum of Art, which has decided not to participate in the Google Art Project. That's an effort to digitize many of the world's art collections. Mr. Franklin, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. I very, very much appreciate it.
And when we return from our break, the latest technology in cars and how it could be compromising your privacy. We'll talk with the editor and editor at Edmunds.com. That's coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
Amid the debate on gun violence, some epidemiology. If you're white and died by gunfire, you likely lived in a rural area, opposed strict gun control, and committed suicide. If you're black and died by the gun, you were likely shot by someone else, lived in an urban area, and supported gun control. I'm Neil Conan. Race, class, gun deaths, and gun policy. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Some light snow showers are likely for today. Little to no accumulation and a high near 38. Cloudy skies for this evening. A chance of some tapering snow and a low of 29. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, filling in for Ann this week. If you have a new car, it's likely packed with technology, probably a touchscreen on the dashboard where the radio used to be. To take advantage of all those technological advances like Bluetooth and navigation systems, you'll have to give the car access to some of your personal information. For most of us, that may not seem like a big deal, but for the privacy conscious among us, it could be cause for concern. Joining us now to discuss what our cars know about us and other car technology is Ron Montoya. He's the consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com. Mr. Montoya, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And for our listeners, if you have a question about privacy, the car technology, or anything about the gadgets in your car, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, that number is 614-292-8513. You can email the show, allsides@wosu.org. And you can also tweet the show at WOSU All Sides and find the show on Facebook. Ron Montoya, you recently wrote about the top five things your car knows about you. Which would you say is most concerning?
I think what would concern people the most is probably their home address. There's a concern that if you leave your car with a valet, they may start up your car, fire up your navigation system, and see where you live, and either write that down or, you know, come to it at a later point in time. So that's one of the major ones that people have a concern about.
Have you seen this happen? Have you seen has any documented cases of people being targeted because of information that was taken out of their car?
You know, I don't know that this happens often, but we have heard of situations that it has happened to some people. It wouldn't be something that would concern a lot of people, but one of the things we offer people is to, rather than put your home address, you can instead put an address that is kind of close to your house where you can kind of take over from there, maybe a supermarket, or some people have even suggested a police station near your home in case, the people write that address down, then they can end up going to the police station rather than your house.
I had not thought of that. The top five things that your car knows about you, you talk about recently navigated locations. That has to do with your home address as well. Also, your phone's contacts. How can that be a problem?
Well, whenever you sync your phone up via Bluetooth, it's going to request your contacts, and it's going to have a log of your recently made phone calls. And in some cars, you can opt out of it, and it will only just receive the calls. But in the cars that do keep that, it's going to have that information available to you. But the good news is that in most cases, the phone has to be present in order for someone to be able to get those numbers.
And also, in the same vein here, emails and text messages. A lot of cars can read your emails and read your text messages for you, and that could be a problem with a valet or a mechanic or somebody else who has access to your car.
Yes, this is similar to your phone in that the phone has to be present in order for that information to be displayed on screen. So what we recommend is, if you're concerned with this, there are some vehicles like from Ford and GM that have valet modes, which is you can enter a PIN code when you leave the car with the valet, and it'll shut off all those features, and they can only just basically control the air conditioner from that touchscreen.
Have you seen people changing a lot of their behaviors because of these new privacy concerns in vehicles?
You know, not too many. It is a concern for some people, but I think for the most part, people enjoy these features. It's a big convenience to them. And I think for people who this is a genuine concern to them, they probably would opt not to get those packages.
Sure. We're talking with Ron Montoya, the consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com. We're talking about privacy concerns that might arise from new technology in your car. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, 614-292-8513, or send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. Perhaps the most interesting, and maybe something that people hadn't really thought about, the technology concerns in their car, speed, braking, and seatbelt use. That's evidently logged in the car's computer?
That's right. So this is found in the event data recorders, or what we call a black box, and it's in pretty much most vehicles that are brand new. And what this does is it captures crash data. So if it has to be in an accident in order for the car to begin tracking this information, but it will pay attention to how fast you were going, whether you were braking or accelerating, whether you had your seatbelt or not. And it's just for the purposes of the manufacturer to be able to know what went wrong in the vehicle and see if there's any defects in the car.
That's very interesting. We have a comment from Tom. He says the GPS is standard. He doesn't want it, wants to disable it. Can he do that?
You know, in some cases, you might be able to. I know some vehicles have like a CD that you could just pull out or a memory card where the navigation data is stored. So it just depends on his make and model of the car, but I would check with your dealership to find out if you can take that out.
Sounds like Tom wants to disable his GPS system. Have you seen any other pushback? Maybe people, kind of a retro revival, people buying junker cars instead of these new ones with all the fancy gadgets?
Well, I don't know that there's been a revival, but I do know that one of the concerns with this technology is that it gets dated very quickly nowadays. You know, as you know, technology moves at a very fast pace, and cars move at a much slower pace with regards to this technology. So what's high-tech now may not be the same a couple of years from now. So they tend to kind of depreciate faster with regards to the technology that they have. You know, you can't really use your navigation as a selling point if it's like 4 years old nowadays.
That's interesting. Yeah, that would be a much bigger issue with cars than, say, it would be with PCs that are, a few hundred dollars to replace, maybe even as much as $1,000. But cars that are, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to replace, that this is a big issue. That makes sense. What other trends for the future in car technology, what other trends have you seen that you're excited about or maybe that you're wary about? What else can we expect in the coming weeks, months, and years?
One of the biggest trends that we are already starting to see is to have apps in your car. You know, we all are used to having apps on our phones, but people want to bring those into the car with them. And so you're seeing a lot of automakers include apps. And in the early stages, it's apps that are music-based for entertainment, such as Pandora, Spotify, things like that. But moving forward, you're going to be able to potentially check your status on Facebook. I know BMW has something like that, and receive text messages in your car.
What other apps? My wife actually has an app on her phone that lets her start her car through her remote start system. Any other apps that are being developed or have been developed?
Yeah, Ford was showing us something earlier this year, which it would allow top stories from the Wall Street Journal and USA Today to be read aloud to the driver of the vehicle. And so they wouldn't have to actually look at the screen. You would just get the computer's voice reading out the story to you so you can sort of catch up on your news for the day.
We're speaking with Ron Montoya. He's the consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com. If you have a question for Ron, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email allsides at WOSU.org or tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. And we do have a caller on the line, Kyle, calling from Athens. Good morning, Kyle.
Hi. I just had a quick question. Most of what's been said so far is about having physical access to the car, being able to be in it, take information. But are there any real or legitimate concerns about any kind of wireless hacking or taking information or data out that way?
You know, that's a good point. Most of the things we've been discussing do involve someone actually being in the car. There have been some cases of people being able to sort of grab codes out of the air to get into a car that has a smart key. But I feel like that technology is a bit sophisticated at this point, and not everyone has access to it. It's not like, some coat hanger that they can use to get into your car. It's much more sophisticated. So that sort of drops down the amount of people that can actually do that.
How would the technology work, or how has that worked in cases where people have been able to quote-unquote hack into a car?
You know, I don't know the specifics of it, but what it basically involves is they have some sort of a thing that gives out a signal, and it's able to grab the codes from the car, because when you have these cars with smart keys, they have a number of codes that are continuously given to the car, and it will grab one of them, and it will be the correct one to actually open up the doors and allow the vehicle to be started up.
Interesting. Questions for Ron Montoya from Edmunds.com, 614-292-8513, 614-292-8513. We've talked about some smartphone apps for cars, also making cars 3G and 4G data compatible and putting Wi-Fi in cars. That's a thing now.
Definitely. We saw this earlier this year. The RAM 1500 announced that it's going to have 3G Wi-Fi access. It's going to come with the car if you buy the technology package, and it's going to allow you to, anyone in this car can log in with a wireless hotspot and, you know, surf the web, do whatever they want, go on their iPad, and, you know, it's just going to be a really cool feature. But I will say that one of these things that people have to pay attention to is it's not free. So after a certain period of time, your subscription is going to run out, and then you're going to have to renew it. And, you know, then you get into the question of, do you want to have a data subscription on your phone plus your vehicle as well? That could get a bit expensive.
Sure. It's just like killing all the apps that are running in the background of your phone. Give us a call again, 614-292-8513. We want to hear from listeners about the comments or concerns about the privacy of their automobiles. Are we better off than we were 10, 15, 20 years ago when we just had low-tech cars? All these gadgets are really cool, but are they really worth the safety risks, in your opinion?
You know, I do think so. I think while some of these are more for entertainment, I think some of these technologies are leaning towards making the car safer. For example, we have lane departure warning, which will give you a warning if you're sort of drifting off in your lane. We have adaptive cruise control, which you can come to a complete stop from, you know, just having this thing, the cruise control on. So while some of these are geared towards entertainment, some of the other technology aspects will make the car safer and make us better drivers in the long run.
We have heard a lot about Google's driverless cars. That technology exists. Google's been doing it, but it's not commercially available. Do you see that as something eventually available to consumers, something that we may eventually see as ubiquitous everywhere out on the freeways?
I do think we're eventually going to be headed towards that point, but I think in the meantime, what you're seeing from most of the automakers, and Google's the only one that's really just saying the car's going to drive itself, but most of the automakers are trying to figure out a way to have the driver be in the car at all times and just have the car sort of take over when he's not paying attention or when you, you know, want to just relax for a bit. And one of the things I saw earlier was a driving simulator that Audi had at the Consumer Electronics Show this year, and it allowed you to sort of be in stop-and-go traffic and not have your hands on the wheel or even the pedals, but if you needed to switch into another lane, then you would take over for the car itself.
And you think that's more likely than remote control or quote-unquote drone cars?
At this point, yes, because, you know, there's too many variables involved. So even if you have one car that can drive itself, you know, you have a lot of variables from cars that don't have automated systems, and you know, it could be potentially dangerous.
I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher on All Sides, and we're talking with Edmunds.com consumer advice editor Ron Montoya about technology in cars, what's being developed, what's already out there, and why things like GPS and Bluetooth can also bring safety concerns. Give us a call and share your thoughts, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. Send your emails to allsides@wosu.org or tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. And Mr. Montoya, you mentioned Audi there. What other automakers are on the cutting edge of this? Which automakers are really leading the way?
Yeah, Lexus also is doing some experimentation. They had a high-tech safety vehicle there, which was able to really pay attention to its surroundings. It had a number of laser cameras around it that can tell, you know, the location of a stop sign well ahead of a person's vision. It could, you know, come to a complete stop. It can be aware of passengers that are around it, pedestrians that are around the vehicle. And it was just a glimpse of what can come in the future.
And we talked a little bit earlier about Pandora and other music applications. Music is a favorite thing of people, near and dear to many people's hearts as they're driving down the road. What other music technology is really being developed, things that people should be excited about?
Well, I think you're going to see more apps that can play music, and this is going to be sort of something too that I think will take over for XM radio and satellite radio, is to have these apps that are free. So you can have like iHeartRadio, the Amazon Cloud Player, AHA Radio. These are all apps that can play music and just stream it wirelessly.
We do have another caller on the line, Mike, calling from Columbus. Mike, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a new car that has a feature apparently that it thinks it's being stolen. So it sounds the horn and won't start. And I've accidentally set this off, I think, 3 times now. I don't know how to stop setting it off. I haven't studied the manual yet. I'm sure there's information there somewhere. But do you have any idea on how to stop it from doing that and to start the car if it does happen?
You know, that's a tough one. I know there are some cars that can start themselves. I don't know if you maybe have the remote in your pocket and are perhaps leaning on that button. But what I would recommend is to take the car to the dealership. It is brand new, so it should be under warranty. I don't think they'll charge you for the repairs of it or whatever it needs. Or at the very least, you can just get a tutorial on the car. I know a lot of times cars are so advanced nowadays that we don't get a chance to learn all the features. And when you go to the dealership after you purchase the car, it's a little bit more of a relaxed environment, and you can really catch up and ask those questions you wanted to.
Yeah, that's what I plan. Okay, well, it could be a nice feature, but you need to know how to use it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Mike. Give us a call. Join Mike and join others who've called the program. 614-292-8513. 614-292-8513. We're talking with Edmunds.com consumer advice editor Ron Montoya about new technology in cars. And Ron, we can't talk about mobile technology without talking about cell phone companies. How entrenched are the big cell phone companies in a lot of this mobile technology?
Well, you know, they have a lot of stakes in this because a number of automakers are leaning towards streaming their mapping data and having all their data go through the cell phone companies rather than satellites. So, you know, this is big on them, and they want to be able to also sell you an extra data package for your car in addition to your cell phone. So they're definitely invested in it, and you're already seeing partnerships with Verizon and T-Mobile. So they definitely have some interest in this.
Again, we talked a little bit about what might be developed by being developed. What are you most excited about? What's out there or not out there that you really think should be out there? What do you really want to see as far as mobile technology in your car?
Well, I want to see, me personally, I want to see things like heads-up displays, like just things that will appear in your windshield that can bring you more aware of your surroundings and let you know if there's any objects that you can potentially crash into, and just more awareness of traffic conditions and things like that. And I know that you know, people are working on these things, but they're a bit far out. But I think that's what sort of has me most excited.
What technology out there might surprise people the most? I'm kind of a layman when it comes to this. I drive an older pickup truck that doesn't have the first of these gadgets in it. What is really out there that might blow people's mind if they heard that this technology exists in a car?
Well, I think you'll be surprised to see that a lot of the aspects that go into a automated driving car are kind of already here in some form or another. For example, you have on some of the more luxury cars, you have a cruise control that can bring you to a complete stop in stop-and-go traffic, and even if you start drifting off in the lane, it will sort of correct itself to get back into its lane. And as long as you have the cruise control set, it will, you know, accelerate back up to the speed you programmed it to. So in some ways, we have some aspects of a automated car available to us now.
My dad always said that not to use GPS because you'll forget how to drive, and he was obviously exaggerating. But is there any concern about this with people being surrounded by gadgets that can do just about everything as they're going down the road, that they will not focus on the task at hand, actually driving?
You know, that is a concern, especially with all the, you know, entertainment features that we're adding to cars. Is sort of, are we getting to a point where we're going to overload our brains in the sense of there's too much going on at once? So that is something to be concerned about. But I think, in my opinion, I think that these technologies will make us better drivers. We're going to just be more aware of our surroundings and just have that technology, you know, help us out as best it can.
Well, Ron Montoya is the consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com, and he writes about car technology. Mr. Montoya, thank you so much for your time this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
When we return here on Tech Tuesday, the latest gadgets with Geek.com writer Russell Holly. That's just ahead here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
After England and France went to war with Germany in 1939, there was a ferocious debate in America over whether the U.S. should come to their aid or go even further and enter the war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the isolationists and interventionists with Lynn Olson, author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And you can explore the largest wilderness area in the lower 48 states with a young couple during their year-long honeymoon. Watch Nature, River of No Return. It's Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
35 degrees with some light snow today, little to no accumulation, a high near 38. Some light snow tapering off tonight, and a low of 29. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing seniors in Central Ohio with one-on-one support from caregivers who receive training, are bonded, and insured. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. And support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann this week. It's Tech Tuesday. Google recently announced that it will be ending its Google Reader service in July. Google Reader was beloved by those who used it as a way to follow any number of blogs and other site feeds on one simple page. Shortly after announcing the demise of one service, Google has launched another. Here to discuss that app and other gadget news is Russell Hawley. Russell is the tech writer for Geek.com. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Hey, so what is this new Google app called, and what exactly does it do?
So it's called Keep, and despite the proximity to the you know, announced downfall of Reader, they don't really have anything to do with one another. Keep, I guess the easiest way to describe Keep would be a digital post-it note, you know, kind of sticky note service for your phone. If you have any Android phone, you can use Keep to take really quick notes, embed a photo or voice command into a note, and it actually takes all of those individual kind of quick messages that you've left yourself and syncs it to all of your electronic devices. So anything that has access to Google Drive, which is essentially anything with a web browser, would have access to those notes in real time. So as you edit in one place, it'll make those changes elsewhere.
So in case people with smartphones don't have ADD bad enough, now they have an excuse to be even less organized with Google Keep. People have been comparing Google Keep to another note-taking app, Evernote. Is that a mistake or is that a fair comparison?
So I think Evernote is a lot more verbose. It's designed for note-taking from my use anyway, in kind of a longer form. You know, I would expect to use Evernote during a meeting or in a you know, classroom environment where, you know, you can apply structure, you can tag, you know, certain credentials. There's a lot of organization that goes on there. The note-taking service that I see Keep being used for is really more of a, you know, write it down quick for something that you need as you're running to the hardware store, and then you discard it as soon as you're done with it kind of service. And the user interface for Keep is just kind of dead simple. It's very simple buttons, very easy to understand, and no kind of extra things going on. Whereas Evernote has got so many features that it's almost clumsy at times to use for simple things.
So there's room for both. A person could very well use Keep and Evernote.
I would absolutely say so.
Give us a call if you have a question about technology, about a gadget. Give us a call for Russell Hawley, the tech writer at Geek.com. Send your questions to 614-292-8513. Again, that's 614-292-8513. 8513. A to-do list manager doesn't seem like much of an innovation for a company like Google. Is there a reason to be excited about this with Keep?
The biggest reason to be excited is if you're, you know, already using a lot of Google services. You know, if you have an Android phone, if you're using, you know, the Google Drive service, then the benefit that you get here is that it's a simple app to install, and it takes these very simple features and puts them everywhere. You know, for someone like me who's got, you know, an Android phone and, you know, a travel laptop and my desktop, you know, having that information, you know, easily accessible across all those things is, you know, just a little bit more useful than, you know, having them on a piece of paper in my pocket or something like that.
Again, we're talking with Russell Hawley, the tech writer for Geek.com. Give us a call, 614-292-8513 if you have a question about Google Keep, Evernote, any other smartphone application, any other computer application, anything at all. 614-292-8513. 614-292-8513. And again, Russell, staying with smartphone apps, there's a bunch of T-Mobile news.
Absolutely. T-Mobile is actually, right now, they are in the process of unveiling a whole bunch of new pricing plans for their network, and really just kind of a general plan moving forward for how they want to handle customers, as opposed to how they've been handling them and how their competition handles them. And they've started by calling themselves the Uncarrier, which is kind of a silly moniker, but they've justified that name by establishing a series of new contract prices that have absolutely no contract. You know, so you have the monthly fee that goes on for as long as you need, but there's no contract that goes along with it.
And that's unique in the cellular carrier industry?
That's definitely unique from a big carrier. What you see a lot of times with prepaid agreements, you pay $30 for a fairly inexpensive phone, and you work yourself up from there, and you can pay monthly. These are the phones that are available in T-Mobile at that time, the top of the line phones that are available, the latest iPhone, all of the phones that are available in those sets, and making them available in a non-contract agreement, which is especially when compared to AT&T and Sprint and Verizon, where they have two-year agreements for these same phones, it's a significant difference in the price that you would end up paying in most cases.
I was a T-Mobile customer for quite some time, and by far the biggest issue with me was reception. If I went 20 minutes outside of Columbus, I couldn't get very good reception at all. Is that something that they should be addressing instead of the contract format?
It's actually something that they're addressing as well as the contract format. The contract format is actually something they borrowed from their merger with Metro PCS, which is a separate kind of regional carrier that they merged with a couple of months back. And the non-contract agreements are something that Metro PCS is kind of famous for. The other thing that they got from Metro PCS was a deployment plan for LTE, which is the 4G network that all of T-Mobile's competitors have been working towards, and have in many areas, pretty substantial networks already. So reception across their 3G and 4G services have already increased in a lot of areas. And they've just announced LTE connection in 8 or 9 different markets, including right here in Baltimore, where I am.
Sure, Baltimore, Houston, and a few other big cities.
Mm-hmm. So there's a ton of improvements, both with how they handle customers and their actual network going on right now.
What is LTE again? Kind of explain that for us.
So when you see 4G speeds get referenced by Verizon or AT&T or Sprint, what they're talking about, the network technology that they're using in order to do that is called LTE. And that's something that's, has been the kind of the driving technology that each one of these carriers has been moving towards. And T-Mobile's, kind of fourth in place to this particular transition of technology, but they've got a pretty impressive plan for, covering a significant number of their customers by the end of this year.
What would you say the kind of pecking order for wireless companies is right now? Is Verizon king, and then the others kind of fall in line after that?
I would say that it's hard to judge on a national scale. I would say that in on the East Coast, I could probably guess that Verizon's kind of the big kid on the block, and then you've got AT&T, and then Sprint and T-Mobile. I think Sprint and T-Mobile are both really close. It would be difficult, especially here on the East Coast, to say which one is the best and which one was the worst. I know if you're on the West Coast, especially up in Washington State and those kind of areas, T-Mobile is often significantly faster than Verizon or AT&T.
Yeah, the speed was never the issue. It was always reception when I went out into the country. We do have Colin wanting to know if the note-taking apps are cross-platform or iPhone to PC, or what's the compatibility there?
So right now, Keep, the application, the ability to take notes, is exclusive to Android, but everything can be accessed through Google Drive, which is available on everything. So in a read-only format, they're available on everything, but to take notes is exclusive to Android for right now. Given how Google spent a lot of time on their iPhone apps recently, so I don't imagine that it's going to stay exclusive to Android for very long.
Sure. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown filling in for Ann, and we're talking gadgets and technology on Tech Tuesday, and we're joined, as we often are, with Geek.com writer Russell Holley. Join the discussion. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, that phone number to call, 614-292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. You can find the show on Facebook, and you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. And a video game you're excited about, BioShock Infinite. Tell us about the BioShock Infinite.
BioShock Infinite actually launched today, and every once in a while when there's a new game, you know, right around the time that I'm on the show with Ann, I kind of bring it up and talk about it a little bit. This is the third in a series, and it's, you know, really kind of pervasive. I mean, it's available on PlayStation, Xbox, the PC. It's not available on Macs, but it's available through, you know, digital download, through, you know, physical DVD purchase. There's a lot of availability here, and it's supposed to be a really popular game, but it's definitely pretty steep on the violent side.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are parents in the audience who are going to hear this name over the next day or two, or have heard it already, the game, you know, following the previous versions of BioShock, it puts, you know, it's a fairly violent game. I mean, it's a shooter with, you know, some other aggressive elements, but it also impresses some pretty interesting morality decisions, especially early on in the game. It's set in the early 1900s, but it's very kind of fantasy, you know, where, you know, future sci-fi. You see a lot of things where, you know, things are made of steam, or, you know, run by steam that you know aren't really kind of possible to do that today. But it's come out today, and so far the response has been really positive.
I don't play video games much at all, if I ever get to. Are sequel video games the trend now?
Sequel video games are definitely the trend now, especially when you've got intellectual property like BioShock that has, you know, the very first BioShock was extremely popular, and the second, you know, kind of dropped that off a little bit. It didn't. It was a little overcomplicated, and it wasn't nearly as impressive as the first one, as far as a lot of the audience was concerned. But then, you know, this new one has come out, and so far the reviews and you know, my personal use seem to agree that it's significantly more like the first game, and, you know, very visually stunning. They did a really good job with it, I think.
And as I alluded to, I'm not a big gamer. What are some recommendations for games if people are not gamers, but they kind of want to dip their toe into the water of video gaming? How would you suggest they do that?
It's really difficult to gauge that statement, right? And it's kind of interesting that I can answer that way, because, you know, a lot of games are moving to, you know, the mobile platform that have the same kind of graphic quality as are on you know, desktops and laptops now. I was looking at a game called Unmechanical, which just came to iOS and was recently a PC game as well. And it's basically a near flawless port of the PC version of the game. It's just available on a tablet or on a phone, whereas it wasn't previously available. So it would depend really on, you know, where you're looking to play. And I think most people who don't consider themselves gamers are significantly happier with the idea of, you know, kind of casually playing a game on, you know, their smartphone or their tablet than mm-hmm. they are, you know, looking for a console or looking for, you know, something to play on a computer now.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, because I do have a couple little Tetris-type games on my smartphone that I will play every now and then, but I've never, at least not in the last 10, 15 years, purchased a console to use a lot. Does a game have to be available on a smartphone or an iPad or some other type of mobile device nowadays for it to be successful? Does there have to be a mobile version?
No, I don't think so. I think that in a lot of cases, the mobile version, and really this is something that was actually unique to Unmechanical. You know, they're usually kind of crippled versions where there's not as much functionality. And one of the interesting things about the Unmechanical game that I mentioned was that it's actually a one-for-one port of the PC version of the game. So it may be, you know, that moving forward, there's going to be more of these kind of options. where you see games that are going to have mobile versions and they're going to be the same game instead of a crippled, you know, kind of not as functional version of the game. But for right now, you know, if you see a TV commercial for a game that's coming out on a console, the mobile version is really not going to be the same.
We do have an email from Sarah. I heard a story on NPR the other day about limiting screen time for young children, but my child loves my iPad and is really good at using it. She's 3 years old. The games are educational. I have a hard time finding a balance. What does Russell suggest? I know he has mentioned before that he has kids.
I definitely have three kids, and each one of them are very, very, you know, tech savvy. They're always picking up, you know, either my tablet or anything like that. And I personally give them a choice between, you know, the television or the laptop or the tablet or, you know, the video game system. They have, you know, 1 hour a day is what they, you know, can split up however they choose. And that includes time that they would spend, you know, doing homework and things like that. So, you know, they, you know, get their homework done and then, you know, they have that hour to spend however they choose.
I remember growing up that I liked video games, but I had friends who did not. Is that a phenomenon that still exists? Are there still kids who are kind of anti-technology, or is it totally ubiquitous? Every kid loves technology now.
I think there are definitely kids who appreciate or, you know, are willing to use technology more than others. I just, you know, from my own social experience, I know that I have one daughter who would rather sit down with a book and another who is, you know, very interested in, you know, the things that go into not even so much playing a game, but like making a movie for fun that she's done with stuffed animals and stuff. So it really kind of varies, I would think, from child to child. I don't think every child is addicted to video games.
We do have a comment from Nancy, question from Nancy. She wants to know if you've seen the new BlackBerry.
I have seen the new BlackBerry, the BlackBerry Z10. I haven't seen the Q10, the one that actually has the physical keyboard. But the Z10 is the all touchscreen version of the new BlackBerry operating system. And it's you know, a very comfortable feeling phone. It's very solid. It's definitely noticeably, you know, taller than the iPhone 5. But the operating system is a huge improvement from what BlackBerry was doing before. Whether or not it's going to be successful is entirely dependent on, you know, how well BlackBerry can deliver applications and software that people really need outside of a business environment. You know, BlackBerry has got this interesting hurdle right now where they need to figure out how to make their hardware be user comfortable as well as business appropriate.
We do have a couple quick questions. An email from James. What are some of the actions one should take when getting a new laptop PC with Windows? Getting rid of bloatware, blanking the hard drive, creating a recovery disk, websites to go to. Do you have any suggestions for when a person gets a new PC with Windows?
It really depends on you know, what you're getting and where you get it from. The biggest thing that you need to do is you know, pay attention to what it is that is going to happen there. You know, what piece of hardware you're getting and what counts as, you know, kind of bloatware. Like with HP, for example, they include a lot of software that you can just kind of one-click delete, but then they also have some really interesting power management tools and things like that if you remove, you're actually going to see a decrease in performance. So it's really one of those things that I don't think there's one answer for anymore. You really have to take it on a case-by-case basis.
And we do have a comment from John, quote, seems to me that Google Keep is an exact clone of a nice little app called Simple Note. It works on all mobile platforms on any computer via a web browser and is dead simple to use. SimpleNote.com has the details. That's from John. Russell Holly, tech writer at Geek.com. Thanks so much again for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm Steve Brown, and you have been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7. NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.